Good afternoon, and welcome to today's conference call, which is hosted by the law firm of Plunkett Cooney. Based in Southeast Michigan, Plunkett Cooney is one of the Midwest's leading corporate law firms, employing 160 attorneys in 9 Michigan cities, and in Columbus, Ohio, and Indianapolis, Indiana. This program is one of 4 sessions that comprise Plunkett Cooney's Informed Employer webinar series. Today's presentation focuses on wage and benefits law issues. Leading today's discussion are Claudia Orr and Donnell Barotto, who are members of the firm's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group. An attorney for nearly 20 years, Ms. Orr focuses her practice exclusively in the areas of human resources, consulting, and employment litigation defense. She is an AV-rated attorney by Martindale Hubble, a national peer review service that focuses on legal liability and general ethical standards. Ms. Orr currently serves as a member of the Human Resources Association of Greater Detroit Board of Directors and is the association's Vice President of Legal Affairs. Ms. Barotto represents employers directly and through their insurance providers in defense of employment-related claims. She works with for-profit corporations and on behalf of municipalities. Ms. Barotto is a member of the American Bar Association. Due to the volume of callers attending today's session and the amount of material to be covered, the speakers have requested that anyone wishing to ask a question be placed into the question queue. At appropriate times during the session, the speakers will take questions. To ask a question, press star, then 1 on your telephone keypad. I will then open your phone line so that you may ask a question for the benefit of all webinar participants. Approximately 100 people are attending today's webinar, so time may not permit questions by everyone. If you have questions that go unanswered today, the contact information for Ms. Orr and Ms. Barotto will be made available to you at the end of the presentation for individual follow-up. Please note that today's session is being recorded, and both the audio file and PowerPoint presentation will be available on Plunkett Cooney's website, www.plunkettcooney.com. Prior to today's session, you are provided with a PDF email attachment containing information about exemptions under the Fair Labor Standards Act for common employee classifications and employment scenarios. While Ms. Orr will touch upon the material briefly, the PDF file is for your review and general reference following today's webinar. At this time, I'd like to turn the program over to Ms. Orr and Ms. Barotto.
Hi, this is Claudia Orr, and welcome to our seminar. First, I'd like to say that because of the amount of material that's going to be covered, we're actually going to hold questions until the end of the seminar, and at that point, we'll put you into the queue and you can ask questions, time permitting. As everybody knows, there's both federal and state laws that have minimum wage and overtime pay requirements, but in most cases, unless it's a very small employer, the federal law is going to apply, and as you all know, it's called the Fair Labor Standards Act. We're going to spend most of our time today addressing that law. However, we're also going to touch upon the Michigan Wage and Fringe Benefits Act and the Sales Representatives Act, which provide the cause of action for unpaid sales commissions at termination. You were told about an appendix, the PDF materials that were sent to you. And I just want to explain to you how to use this chart in the future. If you turn to the PDF that you were sent, you'll see that on the first page they address the executive exemption. And that's what this PDF does, is it talks about each of the primary exemptions that are covered under the Fair Labor Standards Act. And on the left-hand column throughout the handout, you'll see that the test is set out. And then on the right-hand side, you're going to find tips, examples, a little bit more explanation about each of those parts of the test that are on the left. So, for example, under the executive exemption on the left, under A, you see that it starts off talking about the compensation has to be paid on a salary basis at the rate of not less than $455 a week. That's what's known as the salary test. We're going to go into detail more later on in the materials about the salary test. And then you'll see B, where it talks about the primary duty must consist of management of the enterprise or of a customarily recognized department. That's part of the duties test, and we're going to explain a little bit more about the duties test, too, as we go through the materials. So going back to the PowerPoint, The general rule, of course, is that except unless the person's exempt, you have to pay the person at time and one half their regular hourly rate anytime they work more than 40 hours in a work week. There's one exception, which is for the exempt employees. The burden's on the employer to prove that an exemption applies. And some courts have held that that standard is as high as a clear and convincing standard, which is pretty tough. It's more than just a tip of the scales in your favor. So keep in mind that when all things are equal, and you're trying to classify an employee and you're not sure if they should be treated exempt or hourly, it's safer to say that they're an hourly or non-exempt employee. Exempt means that you're exempt from overtime requirements, and non-exempt basically means that they do get overtime pay. You can tell from the PDF handout, looking at it, that they have administrative employees and administrative employees and professional employees and so on, that these exemptions do not apply to blue-collar or manual workers. With few exceptions, of course, all non-exempt employees must be paid at 1.5 times their regular rate for all hours that are actually worked in a work week. By actually worked, we mean, for example, you'll see in a moment that if an employee starts off on Monday with 8 hours vacation, and then the rest of the week they work an extra 40 hours, they've actually only worked 40 hours. That 8 hours of vacation time is not time actually worked that you have to include in the count for the 40 hours. And again, to be exempt, the employee must have the right kind of duties and be paid on the right kind of basis. The Federal Fair Labor Standards Act does not regulate vacation, nor does the state minimum wage law. And you might also know that there's no law, unless it's a youth employee, that requires you to give workers break time or lunch times. Vacation is actually governed under the Michigan Wage and Fringe Benefits Act, and that law considers vacation time to be a fringe benefit, not a wage. So it basically becomes a matter of contract between the parties and what promises you've made to the employees. So in your employee handbooks, you need to be careful about using words that provide some kind of a property right. So you don't say, for instance, that they vest time or that they have earned time, because that can create a property right where you actually have to go through with giving them their vacation time and so on. What you actually want to do is describe vacation in terms of things like they're permitted or they will have X number of hours to be used or they're eligible for X hours per year. And you're only required to pay out unused vacation time or unused sick time or PTO time, whatever you're using, if you've actually promised to do that in a writing. So if you've not made any written promises, you can do whatever you want when the employee leaves your employment and you don't have to pay them out from time that they've not used. An example of what you might want to say in your employee handbook is that the employee may receive payment for unused vacation time at time of termination at the sole discretion of the employer. So you're building into discretion into the policy. And then you say employees will only be eligible for consideration if he or she provides the 2 weeks' notice, works during the notice period, leaves on good terms, assists in a smooth transition, and so on. And then say a full release may also be required. And what that does is it allows you to use unused vacation or sick time and so on as consideration to support a release agreement if you want them to release claims on the way out. So let's now turn our attention to what is compensable time. There's actually a law called the Portal to Portal Act, which was an interesting amendment to the Fair Labor Standards Act. The Portal to Portal Act excludes from the definition of hours worked the time that the employee spends driving to and from work at the start and end of each day. It's because of the Portal to Portal Act that employees are not paid for their drive time to and from work. After the Portal to Portal Act excluded travel to and from work, The issue then became whether time spent in the locker room changing clothes had to be paid. In other words, when does the workday actually start? Back in 1955, the Supreme Court held that time spent donning and doffing, or dressing and undressing, in specialized protective gear just before the end and at the end of the workday, and also time spent showering if you've got to remove toxic materials, is part of the integral and indispensable part of the principal activities, and so you had to pay for that time. But this is different than, for example, regular changing under normal circumstances, where, for instance, the employee has to wash the grease off their hands, or they wore their uniform in, they could have actually worn it in from home, and instead they choose to change in the locker room. So normal changing time and normal cleanup is not compensable time. More recently, apparently we're missing our slides, but more recently, as we catch up, the Supreme Court addressed the Puerto de Porto Act again in the case of IBP Inc. versus Alvarez. And in that case, the issue was, after you've put on this protective gear, what happens if you then have to drive to a different work site or walk to a different work site? Is that time compensable? Or do you, you know, pay them for putting on the protective gear and then they're off the clock again while they travel maybe a half hour away to the work site? The court held that the locker room where the employee changes into special protective gear is actually the place where their work activity and day begins. And so the court held that once they arrive in the locker room and they're putting on their protective gear, that starts their workday. And it continues all the way through the workday as they travel to the work site, as they then perform their primary task, and then as they travel back to the locker room and remove the protective gear. So, again, the locker room is where the principal work site and where the workday begins. As we talk about other travel, basically looking at local travel, the time spent traveling to and from work is not compensable, as we indicated. That's because of the Puerto de Porto Act. But time spent during the workday is. However, if you've assigned the employee to start somewhere else, let's say normally they start work in Detroit and it takes them a half hour to drive to their office in Detroit. But on Tuesday they have to attend a meeting in Lansing and it's going to take them an hour and a half to get there. You pay them for the commute time, the hour and a half, but you can deduct the half hour normal commute that they have. So because they've added an hour onto their local travel time, you have to pay them for that hour. And the same would be true on the way home that night. When we're looking at overnight travel, there are some very complicated rules. And these have to do, for example, with the mode of transportation. So I apologize for the technical difficulties, but we'll get this straight in a few minutes. But the rules are very complicated when you're talking about overnight travel. The mode of transportation, whether or not the person is flying or driving, whether or not the employee is the driver or a passenger. They look at the employee's normal work hours, not necessarily the day of the week, but if it's during the core hours, like 9 to 5, whether it's Saturday or Sunday. They're very complicated rules that apply. And so my advice would be is that if you have employees who do travel overnight and you need to determine how to compensate them, that you should consult with an employment attorney. When it comes to on-call time, whether an employee is entitled to compensation for on-call time will depend on how restrictive the on-call rules are. Recently, the federal appellate court said that police officers were entitled to overtime pay for the off-duty hours, because, although they had to carry pagers and remain within a specific geographic area. They found that the officers could actually engage in a lot of personal activities, that the pagers were rare, and that the officers were not subject to discipline if they failed to respond to a page. So basically, courts are going to look at how restrictive the rules are, whether the employee, how far away the employee can stray, how often their free time is going to be disrupted, the duration of the disruption, and so on. And the more freedom that you provide the employee, the less restrictive it is, the less likely you're going to have to compensate them. I mean, times have basically changed, and no longer is the employee sitting at home waiting for the phone to ring. Instead, they have cell phones, and you can reach them just about anywhere. I know there's cases saying that just because it was a Friday night and the employee couldn't drink, that didn't mean that their life was so restricted that they had to be paid for the time. So, you know, it's less likely today that you have to compensate for on-call time. Okay, let's now look at some payroll issues, and in particular, when overtime pay is required. Again, first, it's based on actual hours worked. So, again, if the first 8 hours of the week was vacation, that's not actual time worked. And, of course, you probably understand that you can't keep changing your work week in order to avoid any overtime obligations. And more importantly, and this does, I do see this come up sometimes, where employers think that they can average between two work weeks. So if an employee worked 20 hours one week and 60 hours the next week, they don't have to pay overtime because on average between the 2 weeks in the pay period, they only worked 80 hours or on average 40 hours a week. That's not true. The second week when they worked 60 hours, they have 20 hours that they worked over the 40, and you have to pay them time and a half for that. And there's an example on the page here with 36 hours the first week, 44 the second. The second week they have 4 hours of overtime. Also for compensatory time off, some employers like to provide that. You know, rather than paying overtime, you can the employer would prefer to give the employee time off. You can't do that to avoid the overtime rules unless you're a public employer or under the rare circumstance where the employer is covered solely under state wage laws, and that's a rarity. So keep in mind that overtime pay is required, and you can't provide them with time off instead. Now, having said that, if, for instance, during a work week, an employee has worked, is going to have to work late on Friday because of a project, you could give them time off earlier in the week so that they wouldn't end up with having to work over 40 hours. So you can play with their schedule, but again, if they work over 40 hours, you've got to pay them time and a half. Let's talk a little bit about wage offsets and deductions. As you know, there are certain deductions that you have to make from a paycheck for payroll taxes like FICA, income, so on. And Danielle, by the way, is going to tell you about a very interesting new case addressing the FICA tax and subpay, so you won't want to miss that. In addition, collective bargaining agreements will require a certain sum that needs to be deducted from union dues. So, you know, that you can deduct from their paycheck. Under Michigan law, whenever you make a deduction, though, that's for the benefit of the employer, the employee must give a voluntary consent in writing. And to be valid under Michigan law, the consent must not be obtained under duress, and it must identify the amount to be deducted and the pay period that the deduction may be made. Danielle's giving this look like, what is that subpay case? So apparently that's not part of the material, so I'll tell you about it now. Basically, there's a case that came out of the Western District of Michigan, and the issue was whether or not the employer who was found itself in bankruptcy was entitled to a huge refund from the IRS for FICA taxes, FICA, of course, being the Social Security tax and Medicare tax that is withdrawn from paychecks, and the employer pays a share of it, and then the employee pays a share of it as well. And what happened is that the Western District said that subpay is not wages, under federal tax laws, and there's a lot of analysis that goes into it. If you don't get our rapid report, you should sign up for it. I sent out a news bulletin on that, so make sure you sign up for these rapid reports. But basically, they said it's not wages, it's ordinary income, and therefore you don't have to pay FICA tax on it. And it did award the employer a huge millions of dollars in refund on FICA tax that it had paid on subpay. And of course, subpay is like a severance pay, but it's tied to the receipt of unemployment benefits. So if your company does have subpay, which is meant to supplement unemployment when employees have breaks in their service and they're drawing unemployment and you're supplementing it, this new case said that you don't have to pay FICA on it and you shouldn't be withdrawing FICA from their paychecks, the employee's paychecks either. So going back to what state law requires, there has to be a written consent, and it has to be for each pay period when the deduction is going to be made. So you can't have like a blanket one consent form that says for the next 10 weeks the employer can deduct, you know, $20 from my paycheck to reimburse it for the cell phone that I lost. That would be an invalid authorization under state law. It's got to be separate for each pay period. While an employer may not be able to deduct for the lost laptop, don't forget you can always file a small claim in like a civil suit or in small claims court. So for a consent to be valid, state law requires that it must do a couple things. One, it's got to be freely given and not under duress. It must identify how much the deduction is and which pay period the deduction can be made from, and then it has to be signed by the employee. Now, I can tell you, talking to people at the Department of Labor in Michigan, they have told me that if you can identify the pay period even in generic terms, like, for instance, the last paycheck that I receive, and there's a way of determining the amount. So, for instance, you more or less fix the value of the laptop up front, that if you lose the laptop, you will pay us $200 from your last paycheck, that would be valid. But there are also rules that require, you know, how much you can take the paycheck down by, you know, based on minimum wage and so on. So you should consult an employment attorney before you do these kind of authorizations. Also, Michigan law permits employers to recoup the overpayment of wages if you recoup it within 6 months of the error. The error must be the result of a math error, a typographical error, a clerical error, or a misprint. It can't just be that you thought the pay rate was one rate and then you negotiated something different. The deduction must be made after all other deductions are made, and the deduction cannot exceed 15% of the employee's gross wages during the pay period, and you can't take the gross wages less than minimum wage when you make these deductions. And also, to collect that mathematical overpayment, you have to provide the employee with a written explanation of the deduction at least one pay period in advance. Now let's turn the discussion to offsets, or from offsets. Let's look at additional amounts that you pay employees. As we've indicated, when you're calculating overtime, it's based on the employee's regular rate of pay. And this is not always necessarily the hourly rate that the employee gets paid, because things, additional payments that you make to the employee may change the regular rate of pay. So, for example, bonuses, commissions, prizes, awards, and so on, that can affect the employee's regular wage rate. And if the payment is attributed to, for example, an entire quarter, you have to go back and recalculate the employee's overtime pay during that quarter. You spread the bonus over that quarter, figure out what the new regular rate would be, and then you pay them time and a half based on that new regular rate of pay. So, for example, let's say an employee's hourly rate is $10 an hour. And let's say each week he works an extra hour of overtime. So the 41st hour would be paid at $15 an hour. That's time and a half. But if that employee gets a bonus at the end of the month, that equates to an extra dollar an hour spread out over the month. His new regular rate of pay would be $11 an hour, and the overtime would then have to be paid at $16.50. So you see, when you go back and you spread the bonus, it's going to change the regular rate of pay, and you have to recalculate it. And that's why some employers hate to pay out bonuses at the end of the year for an entire year's worth of extra compensation, because it does require a lot of recalculation. Now that we've covered some general issues about benefits, deductions from the paycheck, and how bonuses will affect the regular rates, let's now focus a little bit more on the exempt employee in particular. Remember, there's two parts to the test: how the employee is compensated and what the employee's duties are to determine whether or not the employee is exempt. The specific test for each exemption is, again, included in that PDF that we've reviewed, so we're not going to review them separately. The first thing you need to know is that titles do not control. You can call an employee management, but that doesn't mean that the employee is necessarily exempt under the executive exemption. And also, if the employee is still in training and not yet performing the requisite duties, the manager in training is not an exempt employee. Following through with the example of a manager, the duties test would focus on what the manager's primary duty is. This means the principal, main, major, or most important duty that the employee is performing. The determination of an employee's primary duty has to be based on a very intense factual analysis on what the employee's job description is as a whole and what they're actually doing. The Department of Labor is going to look at the relative importance of the exempt duties compared to the other duties that that manager is performing, and the amount of time that he's spending actually performing exempt work as compared to non-exempt work. The employee's relative freedom from direct supervision is also reviewed by the Department of Labor. And the Department of Labor is going to look at the relationship between the employee's salary and the wages that are paid to other employees for the kind of non-exempt work that the employee's performing. So, for example, in retail, you can see that assistant retail managers perform some exempt work, such as supervising or directing the work of others, and they can order merchandise and manage the budget and so on. But if the assistant manager spends more than 50% of their time performing non-exempt work like running the cash register, the Department of Labor is going to say that that is an hourly employee. They are not exempt. And if the manager is closely supervised and doesn't earn much more than non-exempt employees, the primary duty requirement will not be satisfying. So I think you see how this works. The Department of Labor wants to see some consistency in the performance of managerial work. They want to see the manager customarily and regularly performing the duties at issue. The exempt work must be performed with a frequency that is greater than occasional, but it can be less than constant. Sorry again for the technical glitch. These things always happen in webinars. The tasks or work performed customarily and regularly include work that is normally and recurrently performed every work week. It doesn't include isolated or one-time tasks. However, an exempt employee will not lose their exemption if they perform non-exempt work in an emergency. So what is an emergency? Well, when an emergency arises that threatens the safety of employees, a cessation of operations, or serious damage to the employer's property, the work that the manager would perform to prevent such results is considered exempt work. If, however, the exempt employee is routinely performing non-exempt work, they're going to lose their exempt status. Keep in mind that emergencies are rare, and they are things that the employer cannot reasonably anticipate in the normal course of business. So you ought to be able, the Department of Labor says that you ought to be able to anticipate that during the Christmas holidays, the retail manager is, the retail store is going to need a lot more help. And if the retail manager is performing a lot of non-exempt work during that period, that's something that the retail store should have been able to anticipate. What they look at are things that are more unusual, such as a mine superintendent who pitches in after an explosion to dig out workers. But again, assisting non-exempt employees during heavy periods of work or rush orders, that's not going to cut it as an emergency. Now let's turn from the duties test and focus on the compensation or salary test. In order to be paid on a salary basis, the employee must regularly receive each pay period a predetermined amount, and it cannot be subject to reduction because of variations in the quality or quantity of work. And that's where employers get in trouble. They start making improper deductions from the salaried employee's paycheck. With few exceptions, the employee must receive the full salary for any work week in which he performs any work. So if the manager shows up for 5 minutes, he's supposed to be paid for the full week. Now, there's a lot of exceptions to that. We're going to cover them. For example, if the exempt employee does not work at all during a work week, you don't have to pay him for the work week. But an employee is not paid on a salary basis where there are deductions made for absences caused by the employer. So if the employer decides that there's not enough work for the manager and tells him he's only going to work a 4-day work week, that is a deduction that is based on the availability of work by the employer, not the employee. And if you start making deductions, the exemption can be lost. You're going to see a recurrent theme in my explanation as we move forward, where I talk about full day or longer. Generally speaking, under the Fair Labor Standards Act, any deduction that you make from an exempt employee's paycheck, and there are some that you can make, we'll cover them, they have to be for full days. So if an employee is out for a day and a half, you may find that it's permissible to deduct one full day's wages. Or if the employee is out for 2.5 days, you can deduct 2 full days' wages under certain circumstances, and we'll cover them. But it is not permissible to deduct a couple hours because, for example, the employee shows up late for work. One of the examples is if you have a bona fide plan, policy, or practice of providing compensation for time off due to sickness or disability, and where the employee receives payment pursuant to such a plan, policy, or practice, the employer is not required to pay for any portion of the salary for those days. So let's look at an example of how this happens. Let's say that the employer has a short-term disability insurance plan, and it provides 60% salary replacement for 12 weeks. But let's say that there's a waiting period. It doesn't kick in until the fourth day of absence. The employer can make deductions from the salaried employee's paycheck without losing the exemption by doing this. For example, you can deduct for the first 3 days of absence before the employee qualifies for the benefits under the plan. Next, the employer does not have to make up the missing 40% during the 12 weeks while the employee is receiving 60% salary replacement. And finally, the employer would not need to pay the employee for absences after the employee has exhausted the 12 weeks of salary replacement benefits. So you see, you have a plan that's a bona fide plan, and you don't have to pay for absences that are not covered under that plan. The same rules would apply, for example, where an employee is receiving workers' compensation under the state's workers' comp laws. You don't have to pay them for the qualifying period. You don't have to make up the payment that they don't get, you know, the extra 30% or wherever it may be in your state. And you don't have to pay for it if the workers' comp should end. The employer can also make deductions from an exempt employee's paycheck as a penalty for major safety violations. These have to be very serious violations of safety rules of major significance, like smoking in an explosive plant. In my 20 years, I've not seen any deduction that would have qualified underneath this this rule. But when the rule does apply, you can make it for the penalty for any amount that you want. It's not tied to, like, you know, you're subtracting one day from their paycheck or two or anything like that. You just come up with a dollar number, and you can deduct it. So if you catch the guy smoking in the explosive plant, fine him a couple thousand dollars if you want and deduct it from their paycheck. For regular work rule violations, and this is kind of a new rule that just came into existence after the last go-round of revisions to the regulations, basically deduction can be made for unpaid disciplinary suspensions, again, of one or more full days. So if, for example, you have an employee, a manager who has violated your sexual harassment policy, you can suspend that manager for 3 days without pay and deduct the 3 days of pay from their paycheck without losing the exemption. While there are also some miscellaneous deductions that are permitted, for example, while deductions may not be made for absences of an employee caused by jury duty or attendance as a witness or temporary military leave, the employer may offset the amounts received by the employee against the salary for that week. So if the manager has to serve on jury duty and the employee received, I don't know what it is these days, $20 a day, some big check like that, you can subtract that $20 from the paycheck of the exempt employee. Okay, there are also special rules concerning the payment of salary during the first and last weeks of employment. So, for example, if the employee starts or quits work on a Wednesday, you don't have to pay them for the, you know, 2 or 3 days that they weren't there. The employer can pay a proportionate amount of the employee's salary. And you can figure it out either based on an hourly or a daily equivalent, and that would satisfy the requirement. But what you can't do is hire an exempt employee and then terminate them and then start them back up and then stop their employment again and then start them back up and stop them in order to prorate parts of the salary to avoid that the salary basis requirement. Again, just so we're clear, when you're deducting from an exempt employee's pay for absences, it has to be for full days or more. Can never make a partial day deduction from an exempt employee's paycheck. The only time that there is one exception, always the exception, is under the Family Medical Leave Act. The FMLA provides that unpaid leave, even for intermittent and reduced leave schedules, can be granted to exempt employees. So this is a good reason to track the FMLA leave time for exempt employees. If you have a manager who has FMLA leave and is absent 1 or 2 hours every now and then, you can actually deduct those 1 or 2 hours from their paycheck. So why do we care so much about the deductions from exempt employees? Well, an employer that makes improper deductions loses the exemption. And the Department of Labor is going to look at the number of improper deductions, the time period during which the employer made the improper deductions, the number and geographic location of the employees whose salaries were reduced. They're going to look at the number and geographic location of the managers who made those decisions And they're going to also look at whether the employer has a clearly communicated policy that prohibits the improper deductions. And that's key. That's called the safe harbor rule, and I'll tell you about that in a second. But the problem is that when you have improper deductions from the paycheck of a couple of salaried employees in a particular classification, you actually could end up losing the exemption, not just for those couple of employees, but for the similarly situated employees that report to the same decision maker. So it can be a very costly endeavor. And the problem is that the Department of Labor puts the burden on the employer to disprove the number of hours that the employee is claiming that he or she would have received had they been getting working overtime and been paid time and a half. And if you can't dispute it, the burden's on you. It could be very expensive. When you're writing your employee handbooks, you need to make sure that consider whether or not you need to say, for example, that this policy only applies to non-exempt employees. The safe harbor policy, I've got an example in here. Every handbook should have this. It basically says, it's our policy to comply. We don't make improper deductions. Let us know if we do, and if we do, we'll investigate it. And if there's a problem, we'll promptly reimburse you. There's a question about using vacation time in half-day increments from one of our audience members. How you compensate the salary employee is different than how you treat a bank of time. So, for instance, you could say that a salaried employee gets 2 weeks of vacation that they're eligible to take, and you can deduct 4 hours from their bank time. Again, we don't call it banked because you don't want an accrual right or property right. But you can subtract 4 hours from the bank, and now they've got, you know, 9 days and a few hours left to use. But that's different than what you're doing to the paycheck itself. What about additional compensation? Sure, you can compensate salary employees and provide them with additional compensation for extra hours that they work, give them bonus payments. You can give them time and a half for time over that they've worked. If they, say, work more than 50 hours, you start giving them extra amounts. Employment attorneys will tell you that they don't like it when you tie that extra compensation into something that looks like how you compensate hourly employees, like anything over 40, we're going to pay you time and a half. Employment attorneys don't like it. You can actually do it, but employment attorneys don't like it because it kind of sniffs of the idea that they're actually an hourly employee, and the Department of Labor will look at that if they conduct an audit. There are certain rules that will apply to nursing care and medical facilities which will allow an employer to pay overtime under the 880 rule. And we don't have time to cover that here. Generally, again, the rule is anything over 40 hours is compensated at time and a half, but just know that there's this 880 rule that applies to certain medical facilities and nursing homes. Let's turn our attention to sales commissions. The Sales Representative Commissions Act was written with the intent of assessing stiff penalties to the employers who fail to pay commissions due, especially when the employee terminates. And basically the penalty is that if you don't pay everything due the sales rep within 45 days of the day that their engagement ends or their employment ends, you have to pay them the amount owed plus twice the amount owed, again, up to $100,000, plus attorney's fees. So it's got a very expensive penalty involved in it. And in the case of Waring versus Total Manufacturing Systems, the court said that a good faith basis for believing you didn't have to pay those amounts is not going to save the employer from the liquidated damages. About the only thing that would is if it's a math error, and I can't believe that that would actually be a defense of the employer. We made a math error by the time you get done talking to the employee and a lawsuit's filed. I think any math error would have been corrected by that point. It's so important that you avoid the procuring cause doctrine, which basically provides that if a salesperson procured the sale, he gets paid as long as the sales continue. Some courts have said that this is for the life of the part. Some have said that it's for as, if they procured the customer, it's as long as the employer continues to sell to that customer. The procuring cause doctrine should be avoided in all consequences. So what do? Every contract should have in it address 3 points in time. What event will trigger the salesperson's right to earn the payment, when the payment will be made to the salesperson, so now that they've earned it, you get pay them out 30 days later, and also talk about what happens to payment if the employee leaves the company. You could say, for instance, that they have to be employed when the event that triggers the right to be paid, or you could say that they have to be employed at the time that the payment is made. But these are issues that have to be addressed in the contract in order to avoid procuring cause doctrine problems. So I would suggest, even better if you can do it, avoid commissions altogether and instead create a bonus problem or bonus program. Bonuses are treated under the Wage and Fringe Benefit Act as a benefit. And as we discussed earlier, benefits are a matter of contract, just like how you handle vacation at termination. It's a matter of contract. Sales commissions are defined as a straight percentage of the sales, 2% on all sales, something like that, where bonuses, by comparison, are usually like a flat amount per item, or you can do a sliding scale, which also will incentivize the employee to sell more. So you could say, you know, all orders up to 10,000 you'll get 1%, but once you hit 20,000 you get, you know, 5%, and if you exceed 30,000 you get, you know, 6%. So it will encourage the salesperson to hit higher benchmarks, and it will take it out of the sales commission statute. The Equal Pay Act, you need to know that this prohibits discrimination in wages based on sex, not race or anything else, but sex. And what it does is it has the plaintiff comparing her wages to someone who is doing work on jobs that require similar skill, effort, and responsibility and which are performed under similar working conditions. So, for instance, a female employee who's in one classification could compare her salary to a male employee who works in a different classification. They can also compare their salary to their predecessor, and they can also, after they've left their company, compare their salary to their replacement salary. So it's very important that you look at how you're treating the wages of men and women in the workplace and in different job classifications, and also you need to look at how you've been paying the different prior incumbents. Any distinction in wages should be based on a factor other than sex, such as education, experience, and so on. And then just one parting thought under state law. It's unlawful under state law to discipline employees for discussing their wage rates with other employees. So with that, I will turn this over to Danielle.
Hello, my name is Danielle Barato, and I will briefly be discussing the recent changes in the last couple of years to the Fair Labor Standards Act. The statutory and case law regarding the FLSA are constantly evolving, and it's important for employers to be aware of how such changes may impact their policies and practices, and to go back and review those policies and practices as you receive updated information. Claudia mentioned our rapid reports that we've produced out of our labor and employment group. That's one way of receiving that information, and we hope that it'll also spark our clients to take a look at their policies and contact us if there's any needs, and we'll address those with you as well. Although the recent passage of the Health Care Reform Act is certainly big news, many people may not know that it contained an amendment to the FLSA. The primary portion of that amendment dealt with nursing mothers. Under the amended act, employers are now required to provide reasonable break periods for mothers who are breastfeeding, and the break must be provided each time an employee has a need to express milk. The amendment doesn't quantify that. It also does not provide a specific requirement for the length of the break. At this point, we're working under a reasonable standard, and that would obviously, at this point, err on the side of the employee in determining when she needs to have such a break. In addition, the employers must provide a location for the employee to express milk that is shielded from view and free from intrusion from coworkers and the public. Again, we don't know exactly what type of area that would be required, although we do know that a bathroom would not satisfy this requirement and an employer would need alternate arrangements for that employee. Employers, however, are not required to compensate employees for such breaks. This would likely only arise in the case of non-exempt employees, as Claudia has discussed earlier, but also something to be aware of when calculating the compensable time for your employees. There is one exception to providing the breaks, and that would be employers with fewer than 50 employees, but only if the requirement causes undue hardship. At this point, that exception is, and undue hardship is defined as if it would cause significant difficulty or expense in relation to the employer's size, financial resources, and nature or structure of the employer's business. Without case law or even Department of Labor guidelines on this point, if a break can be accommodated, we would be encouraging employers to do so at this point and assume that the exemption would not apply. The Department of Labor has acknowledged the amendment, however, has yet to issue any guidelines regarding specifics of implementation or of the new requirements. Therefore, at this point, we would encourage the employers to comply with the guidelines as they're stated to the best of their abilities and refine the policies if and when the Department of Labor provides further guidance. The amendment also states that no part of the new section shall preempt a state law that provides greater protection. The state laws regarding breastfeeding vary drastically from state to state. In Michigan, presently the only legislation prior to this amendment that addresses the issue of breastfeeding are statutes that exempt breastfeeding from being categorized as public nudity and the penalties that can be applied for public nudity. Therefore, the FLSA amendment would be your guiding point of view on this. The FLSA also continues to be the subject of an increasing number of EEOC charges and lawsuits. I've included a few of the figures, but as you can see, the number of FLSA lawsuits filed nationwide has more than doubled since 2004, and then from 2008 to 2009 alone jumped nearly by 1,000 lawsuits. I've also included some figures regarding recent overtime settlements and judgments just to point out how costly a violation and subsequent suit or charge can be. And as you can see from the descriptions that I've included, these types of settlements and suits affect every kind of employer. For example, two paper stores in New York paid nearly $100,000 to 28 employees for alleged paycheck shortfalls. In addition, five Famous Dave's restaurants in Nebraska paid $90,000 in overtime compensation and post-judgment interest and an additional $90,000 in liquidated damages for their failure to combine the hours of employees who worked at more than one location for the purposes of calculating overtime. Even Walmart fell subject to such a suit and recently paid $640 million to settle 63 wage and hour suits from across the country regarding off-the-clock work, failure to provide required meal and rest breaks, and failure to pay overtime. In addition to statutory amendment, the body of case law concerning the FLSA is also in constant flux as new decisions and determinations are made by our courts. The following cases are the more significant of these decisions that have come out in the last 2 years on some of the hot-button topics. Claudia earlier discussed the FICA tax. Another loss of exemption I would like to discuss was in Baddenwood, Winterwood versus Lifetime Fitness. This case demonstrates how the loss of the exempt status for one employee can result in significant liability for unpaid overtime for not only that employee, but also all of the employees in the same classification. In Lifetime, the court found that their policy, which provided that if certain performance indicators dropped below 80% and bonus payments had been made in previous months, it could reclaim the amount of previous payments by reducing future salary payments, violated the salary test basis. The court reasoned that Lifetime had the right to recoup overpayments, as Claudia discussed earlier. However, it could not do so by dipping into plaintiffs' guaranteed salaries and deductions, which were based on the quality and quantity of the employee's work without losing the exempt status. The court found that Lifetime was liable for overtime pay to not only those plaintiffs, but all of the employees in the same job classification working for the same managers responsible for the improper deductions. They also applied this to all pay periods where improper deductions were taken. Therefore, the verdict was far beyond the scope of just the plaintiffs in that suit. Touching on the executive exemption that Claudia mentioned earlier, it has also been the subject of several high-profile overtime cases. typically involving employees who are managers in name only or who also perform the job duties of non-exempt employees in their charge. One such case is Rodriguez versus Farm Stores Grocery. In that case, the court found that it was not sufficient to just merely name the employee a store manager, that the court was going to look at the actual type of work performed, and that would be a fact analysis in that exemption. Starbucks fell under a similar problem where they found that there was an issue of fact existing concerning whether the plaintiff's managerial duties of their store managers were less important than their non-managerial duties, and that would be a balance that the courts would weigh in looking at whether an employee was exempt or not. Another issue that seems to arise more frequently with recent necessary layoffs is many companies miss meal periods. And skipping back just for one second, tips and meal and lodging credits come into play quite a bit, as we've seen. In a recent unpublished case out of the Sixth Circuit, the court demonstrated the importance of an employer providing employees with notice that it intends to treat tips as satisfaction of part of the employer's minimum wage obligation. In that case, the defendant restaurants were not entitled to a retroactive tip credit because they had failed to inform employees that their wages were being decreased under the FLSA's tip credit provision. Although the employer had notified its employees that their pay would consist almost exclusively of tips, that was insufficient as they did not discuss the employer's obligation to pay minimum wage or explain to their employees how the tip credit applied against that obligation. Additionally, the court in that case held that the employers were not entitled to a credit for meals or lodging that they had provided because they had not maintained and produced contemporaneously maintained records reflecting the number and actual cost of the meals provided to the employees and the value that the individual employees, the value of the housing that the individual employees occupied. Therefore, the employers had provided these benefits to the employees but were not able to recoup on the credit for those things because of their lack of records. Finally, the court in that case also imposed liquidated damages. In reasoning, they stated that the liquidated damages under the FLSA are considered compensation and are not penalty or punishment, and that they are mandatory under the Sixth Circuit and should be considered the norm. The employers tried to provide a defense that they had good faith due to their claimed ignorance of the law, adherence to cultural practices, and language difficulties. However, the court rejected that defense and imposed liquidated damages anyways. One must also be careful on how an employer treats tips. Even Robert De Niro cannot escape the reaches of the FLSA, as we saw in a recent settlement with one of his restaurant groups, Nobu. In a Southern District of New York case, a class of waiters, bartenders, and bus staff working for the Nobu group settled their claims that the restaurants had violated the FLSA by requiring them to share their tips with managers and sushi chefs. The settlement in that case was $2.5 million. Going back to the issue of records and the importance of maintaining that, a recent decision came out in the Sixth Circuit, O'Brien versus Ed Donnelly Enterprises. One of the significant points out of this was that the court affirmed an employee-friendly burden of proof that when an employer maintains inaccurate or inadequate records, the plaintiff does not need to prove every minute of uncompensated work, but rather is allowed to simply estimate his damages, shifting the burden to the employee. If the employee cannot negate the estimate, then the court may award damages to the employee, even though the result would only be approximate. Obviously, that would be a decreased burden of proof for the employee and would hurt all employers. Additionally, in the O'Brien case, on a related note, it represented a significant relaxation of the standards previously used to evaluate whether employees' FLSA claims will be certified for collective action. Without getting into the intricacies of collective actions under the FLSA, this relaxation would therefore make it easier for plaintiffs to bring a collective action, which is similar to a class action if you've never dealt with one before under the FLSA. Finally, returning to the issue of the spoliation of records, a similar case of Brown versus Family Dollar Stores found that a former assistant manager was permitted to proceed with a claim under the FLSA where she was not paid for overtime despite a lack of evidence, as plaintiffs did present evidence that the management altered her time records. In that case, the plaintiff could not even point to the specific days or hours that she worked overtime and was not compensated for it, however, did provide evidence that the management had altered it, altered the paychecks after they were submitted accurately by the employee, and that they could look as a retail store at the hours that the store was opened and the time spent opening and closing the store, and that she would need to be there for those hours to evaluate that she was not paid for the appropriate amount of time that she should have been. Again, those records will be helpful in any investigation, audit, or lawsuit if one should arise. On behalf of Claudia, myself, and all of the Plunkett Cooney attorneys, I'd like to thank you for participating in the presentation portion of the first session of Plunkett Cooney's Informed Employer webinar series. We have provided the handout materials to you already, and as was mentioned earlier, our PowerPoint slides will be available on our website. I'd also like to encourage you to sign up for the additional portions of the series, and those dates are coming up on June 15th. There will be a presentation on the FMLA, ADA, and workers' compensation. On September 16th, we'll be doing a presentation on labor law for non-union employers, and on October 14th, we'll be doing a presentation on discrimination, retaliation, and the Whistleblowers Protection Act. Additionally, we will be conducting a summer camp, an overview of employment law and HR best practices, which is geared at mid-level HR professionals who want to know about labor law and employment issues and everything that they're afraid to ask. Additionally, we will be sending a survey following today's program, which I would encourage you to fill out and give us feedback on anything and everything. I believe at this time we'll open up the floor for questions if you have any.
Thank you. The question and answer session will be conducted electronically. If you'd like to ask a question, please do so by pressing the star key followed by the digit 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. We will proceed in the order that you signal us, and we'll take as many questions as time permits. Once again, please press star 1 on your touch-tone telephone to ask a question. We'll now take the first question from Donna Beltran from the Taubman Company.
Hi, yes, I had a question about the new requirement under, in connection with the Health Care Reform Act that requires that breaks be provided for nursing mothers, and there's a 50-employee limit, you know, with the exception, you know, with certain exceptions, the undue burden exception applied. I wonder about the 50-employee limit, whether that applies per location or per total company size.
Thank you, Donna. This is Danelle. At this point, we don't have any further guidance on that. The actual statutory amendment just specifies less than 50 employees without qualifying it any further. So that's something that we would certainly be looking to the Department of Labor to establish some guidance on as the amendment goes into effect and before we have any case law on that type of issue. At this point, I would assume that
just
any employer.
Yeah, if you have 50 or less, the employer, not the work site, that's how I would look at it. But keep in mind how laws are passed. You start off with a very vague outline of what the law is, and then after that, law is assigned to a particular department or agency to regulate it, and they issue regulations that kind of fill in the blanks. But even, as you know, with the Family Medical Leave Act regulations and the ADA regulations, you still have a lot of unanswered questions, and the questions that remain unanswered get answered by the courts as they interpret the law. So it takes a while for laws to develop, but at this point I would say if you as the employer have 50 employees or less, not just at a work site but company-wide, that it's safe to look at it. And the undue hardship is basically the kind of analysis that you would use for the ADA when you consider whether or not a request for accommodation creates an undue hardship.
Thank you.
We'll take the next question from Yvonne Herman with Sisters of Mercy, WNW. And your line is open.
While we're waiting for the employee to unmute his or her phone, we do have a question sent in electronically from Yvonne Herman asking if an employee can refuse to take lunch. The answer is it's the employer's right to require employees to take lunch or not take lunch. And, of course, if it's and the employer doesn't have to pay the employee for their lunch period either. So if the employer believes that it's important for employees to refresh themselves in the middle of the day, they can require employees to take the half-hour lunch or the hour lunch, and it can be unpaid.
I would note there is a recent wage and hour opinion letter that goes to this point as well, that time worked during a missed meal period can be considered time worked under the FLSA, though. It gets into a pretty fact-specific analysis, but this rule can hold true even if the employee violates the employer's pre-approval policy for not taking a lunch and for working during those periods. So that would be something that you'd want to look at closely, even if you do have a policy in place requiring employees to get pre-approval for not taking a lunch.
Yeah, it becomes an issue of discipline. Remember, you have to pay an employee for all time actually worked. And so if they're working overtime, you can't just give it a nod and a wink and say thanks for the donating the time. You have to pay them for it. Same thing would be if they're working through their lunch hours. You can discipline them for the violation, but you would still have to pay them for it. There's also a question under the new health care regulations. We don't really know what the law requires yet at this time. That's something that's going to have to be addressed during a future seminar. Are there any other questions?
Yes, we'll go next to Joanne Benson with Beaumont Hospital.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. My question was, you mentioned that you have some upcoming webinars, three more, and I went to your website really quickly. They're not located on there yet. Do you know when they will be?
We do. The next one will be on June 15th.
No, I mean, when will I be able to sign up for it? Because they're not listed on the website yet.
We will take action to correct that, so should have it up within a day or two at least.
Okay. All right. And then also you mentioned the rapid report, and I was wondering how I go about signing up to get that as well.
If you want, you've got my contact information, theor@plunkettcooney.com. Just shoot me an email, and I'll make sure that you're on our list.
Okay. Thank you.
We have a question from Ann, and the question is, can you make a half-day deduction from a salaried employee during their last work week? No, full days or more. And the last thing you'd want to do is lose the exemption as the employee's on their way out the door. Any other questions?
Yes. We'll go next to Donna Beltran from the Taubin Company.
Hi again. My question is, can the exempt status be lost if an employee who's already, you know, had their full FMLA leave and it's been exhausted, if we then allow her to go to a part-time status based on a potential disability situation, if we pay her for partial days, straight pay, and then she is supplemented with short-term disability at a 75% rate for the rest of those partial days?
I'm sorry, did you say your name was Donna?
Yep.
Donna, this is the kind of question that's so fact-specific, and I'm going to have so many questions to be able to answer this properly. Why don't you give me a call in my office, and we'll talk more about this.
Okay, thank you.
Claudia, right?
Yep. Okay. Any other questions?
And at this time, there are no further questions.
All right. Well, we would like to thank everybody for taking part. You've been a joy to address, and hopefully we will see you at one of our upcoming seminars. Thank you.
This does conclude today's conference call. We thank you for your participation.